Welcome to Alternatives, a podcast about alternative culture and its possibilities, or lack thereof.
Hello and welcome to Alternatives, a podcast for Zero Book subscribers. I'm your host, J.G. Michael. Today's edition will be a little bit different from our usual format in that I am not joined by my usual partner in crime, C. Derek Varn. Instead, we're joined by a special guest, Eric Wilson. Eric is a senior lecturer at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. He has a PhD in history from the University of Cambridge. Areas of interest and research include critical legal theory, criminology, and the history and philosophy of international law. These interests led him to delve into a subset of radical criminology known as parapolitics, or what many would try to offhandedly refer to as conspiracy theory. He's the editor of a volume entitled The Dual State, Carl Schmitt, Parapolitics and the National Security Complex, as well as the author of The Spectacle of the False Flag, Parapolitics from JFK to Watergate. Tonight we will be discussing his latest book, released by Pumpkin Books in 2016, The Republic of Cthulhu, which continues his exploration of parapolitics, but this time through the lens of H.P. Lovecraft's horror fiction universe. Welcome, Eric Wilson.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
The first thing I'd like to cover before we really delve into the meat of the book is this idea of parapolitics, because as I mentioned, a lot of people would sort of refer to it as conspiracy theory, but I think we all know that in popular culture, conspiracy theory has a bit of a bad rap. It's usually used as a very pejorative slur. Do you think there's a difference between parapolitics and what we usually conceive of as conspiracy theory?
Sure, because parapolitics is not conspiracy theory properly so-called, which is always about the conspiracy. Parapolitics is really just an academic term that we've invented to try to conceptualize the problem of political crime. And by that, we don't mean state crime, meaning states breaking international law, as let's say is arguing going in the case of, let's say, Syria today. Rather, it's states that actually engage in criminal behavior, even under their own national legislative and criminal codes, against their own people, against people of other states. So what we're really looking at is trying to come up with a way of formulating the various convergences that take place between state agencies, national security agencies, national intelligence agencies, paramilitaries, independent military contractors, private security firms, and in certain circumstances, even organized national or international crime cartels. So therefore, the link with that, all of that and conspiracy theory is that if you have these kind of coalitions, which are sort of taking place under the radar and only occasionally intruding into public space and direct perception, then of course you've created an arena for which conspiratorial behavior can take place. But it's not really about the conspiracy itself. It's about the extrajudicial nature of power in the contemporary globalized state.
Okay, I think that's a great way to put it.
Thanks.
So what I'd like to do to really get into the meat of your book, one of the things I mentioned in our email exchange before the show was the way you juxtapose the alienated scholar in many a Lovecraftian weird tale, and the way that the alienated scholar comes face to face with a cosmic horror. And you juxtapose that alienated scholar with an actual scholar by the name of Peter Dale Scott, who I'm a huge fan of, greatly admire. Who is Peter Dale Scott for our listeners, and why did you choose him to make this juxtaposition?
Oh, Peter is a former professor of literature at the University of Berkeley in California. And about 11 years ago, I invited him for a conference to Melbourne, which became the basis of a book that I edited called Government of the Shadows. And he encouraged my work. He was quite keen on the fact that I was interested in trying to establish a connection between parapolitics and critical or radical criminology. And he suggested that, among other things, although I was kind of pre-inclined to do this myself anyway, was to sort of go down the path of literary scholarship and comparative literature studies and try to think of a way in which uncomfortable truths about the connections or the various nexies or nexi between state and non-state actors can be expressed either in its substantive content in literature or through a kind of a poetics. You get a book like, let's say, which I think is the greatest parapolitical novel ever written, which is Libra by Don DeLillo. And although it's ostensibly about the Kennedy assassination, and he does present in the book a very minimalist notion of the conspiracy, it's really about a whole bunch of other things, about American involvement in Cuba, U.S. governmental involvement with the mafia, the intrusion of the mafia into judicial law enforcement bodies, and the whole notion of domestic intelligence agencies spying on people, manipulating people for various purposes, for both intelligence and counterintelligence purposes. So I think that's really how all that started. And when I started writing my what was really just an essay on the Call of Cthulhu and turned into like a small book about the Call of Cthulhu, the more I was focusing on the narrator, and of course there are multiple narrators because the narration in that novella is, shall we say, packaged like Chinese boxes. You unfold the diary, which reports a letter, which is in fact the letter writer's reading of a diary written by somebody else. And of course, you go down all these things. And I just think the longer I was looking at this guy, I kept on figuring this is something that Peter would do. You know, this would be the sort of like fine textual analysis that Peter Dale Scott would engage in. And I think that the image just got welded in my mind that Peter is sort of uncovering unspeakable truths about our political universe, just like Lovecraft, very, very tongue-in-cheek, was revealing horrific truths about our physical and metaphysical universe.
Right, right. And I think there's a lot of like areas of comparison to be made, especially when you start delving into Peter Dale Scott's poetry, because a lot of his poetry deals with trauma as it relates to his uncovering of these uncomfortable parapolitical realities. That trauma is comparable to what you call brain blasting in Lovecraft's fiction. So if you could like deal with that idea of trauma in parapolitics and brain blasting in horror and the similarity there.
Well, brain blasting is Lovecraft's own term. And it's sort of like, there's no doubt that he was intellectually a genius or at least a near genius. But in literary terms, he was, in a sense, he's a one-trick pony. Because every Lovecraft tale, I think we'll probably talk about this a little bit later. There's the early Lovecraft and the late Lovecraft, who are actually very, very different writers in many ways. But certainly the late Lovecraft, the payoff of the every story is the scream. Because there's very little action, there's very little plot. Sometimes there isn't even really any plot at all, because the Call of Cthulhu is us reading a whole bunch of written testimonies by people who are all dead. But what you have is this kind of bringing about of a mental realization of how completely disjointed the ordinary and the everyday is from the occulted and the invisible and the quasi-transparent. And it's that sort of emotional ripping of the self when you realize that, you know, Cthulhu has at least temporarily entered our space-time zone for a short period, and you actually look at the beast which is standing behind everything else that happens. It's that primordial scream that is the Lovecraftian experience, you know, per se. And all the language, all the poetry, all the flowery prose is really just a way of leading you into that precise moment where you can do nothing else other than go hopelessly insane.
Right, right. And I think it's a good comparison to make with parapolitical investigators, because they are experiencing their own version of that scream when they uncover the horrible reality of the parapolitical.
The most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate all its contents. We live on a placid island of ignorance in the midst of black seas of infinity, and it was not meant that we should voyage far. The sciences, each straining in its own direction, have hitherto harmed us little. But some day the piecing together of dissociated knowledge will open up such terrifying vistas of reality and of our frightful position therein that we shall either go mad from the revelation or flee from the deadly light into the peace and safety of a new dark age. Theosophists have guessed at the awesome grandeur of the cosmic cycle wherein our world and the human race form transient incidents. They have hinted at strange survival in terms which would freeze the blood if not masked by a bland optimism. But it is not from them that there came the single glimpse of forbidden eons which chills me when I think of it and maddens me when I dream of it. That glimpse, like all dread glimpses of truth, flashed out from an accidental piecing together of separated things, in this case an old newspaper item and the notes of a dead professor. I hope that no one else will accomplish this piecing out. Certainly, if I live, I shall never knowingly supply a link in so hideous a chain.
What one last thing about this comparison that you make between Scott and the Lovecraftian protagonist. I feel like there's a key difference in that Scott is driven by a very deeply progressive and humanistic sentiment, I think.
Yes.
And I think his horror at encountering what you call the parapolitical sublime is that it undermines the values he most cherishes, namely things like social justice, democracy, and egalitarianism. I think Lovecraft, his conception of parapolitics as it is in his horror stories, it comes from a very different place. And I think it's relevant to unpack that, especially in like this era of Donald Trump and the alt-right and Alex Jones. So if you could unpack that a bit, Lovecraft's parapolitics.
Okay, two things, one short thing and one longer thing. The thing that I'm most proud about my book, if I'm proud about any of it, thing at all, is that it was published by Punctum on November 7th, 2016, which, as you may remember, is the eve of the U.S. presidential election. So I thought that was it was a very good sign from above or below that I was going to get some traction with this thing. The other thing I should mention as well is that one of the contributors to my book on the dual state, just talking about the Trump administration for a second, one of my contributors to the dual state book that I did was a very, very prominent Scandinavian national security scholar called Ola Tunander. And in that, both in the first book, Government of the Shadows, and the second book, The Dual State, he was writing about the dual state in Turkey and the overlap between the Turkish intelligence agencies and the heroin production and export cartels in Highlands, Turkey. And of course, that takes us back to the shadows of the French Connection and the Sicilian Connection, a few other things. And he is actually the one who coined the term the deep state. And it's not too long after Donald Trump got elected that the phrase deep state started appearing, although Trump was applying it in a counter-reactive sense, in that he was talking about James Comey being part of the deep state, meaning the unelected officials of Washington who are trying to undermine the elected president. So I like to think there's actually a direct connection between my book, Ola's work, and the Trump administration, because we are actually the group of people who came up with the phrase deep state, although trademark belongs to Ola primarily, and possibly even exclusively. On the way, Peter picked it up and ran with it and popularized it as well in his various books about 9/11 and the American war machine. But going a little bit deeper, I think the thing that's germane here is, I'll put it to you this way. The two best books about Lovecraft, secondary books on Lovecraft, ever written are by two French guys, French scholars, Maurice Levé and Michel Houellebecq, who's actually a very prominent author in contemporary France.
We actually, Zero has published a book on Houellebecq. Yeah.
Really? I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. That's great. That's fantastic. No, that's good because he deserves a much wider readership. You kind of have to read him with gloves or sort of use tongs to turn the pages sometimes. But he's if you've got a very strong stomach and you're not very politically correct, he's a great read. But what they both pointed out, and I follow up on this and I kind of add detail to it in my own book, is that the secret of understanding Lovecraft is that he started out as this kind of very willowy, Dunsianite, you know, Lord Dunsany type of writer. And the great gods, the ancient ones like Naherothotep or Gulhulu or Azathoth as they appear in those novels are really very kind of anemic, somewhat underwhelming, decadent, orientalist, you know, late 19th century fin de siècle type of people, because he's imitating Dunsany to such a great degree. Then in 1925 and 1926, he moved to Brooklyn, New York. And he appeared to have undergone a complete and total mental breakdown because he was exposed for the first time in his life to immigrants and minority communities and racial diversity. And he underwent such almost visceral, if not traumatic, psychological reaction to all of this that he could only sort of like apply self-therapy to himself by through his writings. And what he started doing was he began reconfiguring his earlier Dunsanite creations into these parodies of psychotic and pathological racist fantasy and, you know, eugenics hate speech. And it's interesting that you also learn, and Levy is absolutely right about this, almost all of the major Lovecraftian tales of the second half of his life are actually rewrites of tales from the first half of his life. Like, the Call of Cthulhu is just a really, really, really dense commentary on his very first published tale, which I believe was Dogon, which is published in 1917, which has all of the essential elements of the Call of Cthulhu in it, but it's absolutely minimalist. It's just pared down to nothing like, it's sort of like a really bad nightmare with some out-of-body experiences. But in Cthulhu, he inflates the whole thing to the level of a cosmic conspiracy. Because, and this is what I do pick up on, and I don't think anyone's picked up on it quite as much, certainly not in the way that I've done it, I think, is that when you shift from mere fantasy to specifically racist fantasy, you start getting locked into a narrative pattern in which you have to start coming up with conspiratorial tales. Because that's exactly what the Call of Cthulhu is. Cthulhu is sort of, he's mind melding with racial minorities all over the world to try to incite a genocidal race war against Caucasians. And so it's anti-imperialist, it's anti-colonialist, and it displays what we call reverse colonization. And some of the great works in horror literature, like War of the Worlds by Wells or Dracula by Stoker, really are reverse colonization tales, in that we who have colonized extensively, I mean, we've completely colonized the world, the United States, Britain, France, their worst fantasy, if we use literature to express fears and phobias, is that of the counter-colonizing force, in which the racial other simply turns the tables on us, inverses the hierarchy, and begins colonizing us in a way in which we have done them, although you use horror fiction or conspiracy fiction as a means of camouflaging what it is that you're talking about. And some of your viewers probably know this, but the War of the Worlds is actually Wells's fictionalized version of a real event that took place here in Australia, which was the Black Line in Tasmania in the 1830s, in which the first waves of British settlers stretched themselves out in this 200-mile-wide cordon and went through the whole of Tasmania, killing any native Tasmanian, any Aboriginal Tasmanian they came across. And that was his idea of the Martian invasion of Britain, turned inside out and then stood upside down.
I think this sort of gets into an interesting topic with regards to Lovecraft and his early fiction versus later fiction. There's an author by the name of John Dolan. He's sort of more well known as the war nerd, Gary Brescher. That's his pseudonym. But he's tried to argue that the latter portion of Lovecraft's writing, particularly at the Mountains of Madness, shows Lovecraft making an attempt to be more empathetic or to try to understand the other. And it sort of goes against his idea of Lovecraft's sort of older xenophobia in his earlier stories. I don't know if you agree with that, but do you think there's anything to that?
Yeah, Mouth of Madness and also the ending of The Shadow Over Innsmouth as well seem, if you read between the lines somewhat, does seem to indicate kind of a desire for reconciliation, certainly an admiration for these creatures that he's fabricating. At least the elder ones or the great ones, as he in another tale as well, Shadow Out of Time. He does seem to be engaging in kind of a voyeuristic, slightly eroticized admiration of the aliens he's describing. And I've read some secondary literature that applies his Deleuzian analysis to suggest that he's really trying to come to terms with his own body, which, of course, as we know, one of the things that was driving his various neuroses, apparently, is that he was convinced he was infected with syphilis, which, of course, his father died from very, very horribly. And so he had this fear of the contamination of his own body. And it may, in fact, be in part, I don't know how much political this is and how much this is personal, but may be in a part an unconscious attempt by him to actually reconcile himself to his own alien nature.
Right, right. And I think we see that a lot in the Lovecraft story, The Outsider. There's been a lot of analysis trying to argue that that's Lovecraft dealing with his own feelings of abjection, essentially.
Yeah.
You state that cosmic horror, or what Lovecraft would call cosmic indifferentism, seeks to overthrow anthropocentrism. And you find a similarity here, where you say that parapolitics also seeks to overthrow something, namely our perception of the political.
I was working on another essay today, and I came across a reference to a quotation from Herodotus, from his histories, which is about the Persian War. And the quote goes to the effect that of all the afflictions of man, the most painful is to be aware of much, but capable of doing nothing. And I think this is probably the most single most persuasive anti-liberal sentiment ever expressed, because one of the conceits, whether it's an actual lie or not, I'll leave it up for everyone to decide, but certainly one of the conceits, one of the fundamental presuppositions of democratic politics, like why elections matter, democratic government, like why the rule of law matters, why due process matters, why the separation of powers, checks and balances matter, is that human agency is rational in essence and is effectual in its operation. That by engaging in a social contract, by engaging in deliberations, by engaging in discourse, not only are we possible at arriving at an objective truth, which is ordinarily amenable to human needs and interests, but we can then practically improve our collective existence by implementing these policies through a political system that's transparent enough that our collective will can be effectively represented by the institutions in whose names they claim to represent us. And that's a whole series of really dodgy assumptions almost everywhere along the chain, but they seem to be absolutely essential to political life as it's been defined, at least in the Western tradition, for the last 2,000 to 3,000 years.
Right.
All the way back to Plato and Aristotle.
The founders of our government were influenced by the spirit of their times. For our revolution was part of a world revolution. Whose watchwords were liberty, equality, and fraternity. Out of the turmoil of these times, a French philosopher, Montesquieu, published a book on the spirit of the laws. From this book, the builders of our Constitution derived the theory of a government of separate branches and of checks and balances, whereby each branch of government might prevent the abuse of power by the other. Too much government from England had resulted in tyranny and had been one of the causes of the revolution. Too little governmental power in the Confederation had led us to the verge of anarchy. As a solution to these two evils, therefore, the Constitutional Convention adopted this theory of checks and balances. This framework of government has expanded to cover all our needs. It is still sufficient to provide a perfect union, to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility, to promote the general welfare, and, under God, to secure the blessings of liberty and to our posterity. It still stands to demonstrate to all the world that a government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth.
And I think another interesting area that this gets into is you state that the Lovecraftian protagonist sort of represents the height of Kantian pure reason, and that the protagonist is then annihilated by the irrational.
Yeah. Oh, and, sadistically destroyed, actually. Yeah.
Right, right. And I think that also occurs with the person who starts investigating the parapolitical. Because it's within a liberal context, you know, ideas like the Dole State actually go completely in the opposite direction of our conception of liberalism.
And I think one of the reasons, I'm sorry, just for jumping in for a second, I think one of the reasons for that is the idea, whether it's true or not, it's inherently too dangerous to be considered as true. Because the very idea of it undercuts the central premises of the liberal conceit, or the Nietzsche would call it the liberal prejudice, as I've laid it out, because it really does reduce our agency to a degree that is either far weaker than we believe, if not, in fact, nondescript or even non-existent as such.
Right. Right. And I think now is a good time to talk about, you say that there are four signs of the parapolitical: governance, duality, nomadicism, and the irrational. So if you could explain what you mean by that.
Okay, well, by governance, I don't really mean government in the sense of the public institutions. I mean governance as the sum total of activities that can create political effects, which can, of course, include criminal activities. You can govern through corruption. You can govern through organized crimes. You can govern through proxies. You can use mercenary forces or private security firms to affect law and order. There are all kinds of opportunities by which power can be exercised in extrajudicial and non-judicial means, which over time, if successful enough and do not exact too high a price from too many people too often, can in fact acquire a degree of legitimacy within its own right. By nomadicism, I simply mean the issue there more of liminality, that international or national actors, state, sub-state, and non-state, because they're engaged in each other in a rather shifting pattern of coalitions of governance factions rather than governmental factions, can of course cross borders and produce effects in areas that are completely outside their own domain. For example, the illegal war waged by the United States in Cambodia and Laos during the Vietnam War period created entire new economies, entirely new communication networks, entirely new transportation networks, and all kinds of intelligence connections that never existed there before. And of course, the more important the war became, meaning the more money was being funneled into it, the more these actors were able to directly exert influence, if not formal power, informal influence over official and public decision making. And by irrationality, what I simply mean is that, and this really is kind of, again, going back to the liberal conceit, liberalism, sort of like modern law, certainly within the Anglo-Saxon tradition of the common law, really depend upon a whole series of common sense assumptions about the nature of reality and the nature of human behavior, that we are rational utility maximizers, that our egoism is subject to temperance by cost-benefit analyses over time, and that we are, in fact, capable of engaging in contractual forms, contractual relationships, for the betterment of everybody. But the great thing about parapolitics is that it shows not only how informal and privatized the exercise of power and governance can be, it also shows how completely irrational it is. I mean, some of this stuff has not been completely proven, but there is some good evidence, for example, of the involvement of American military and security and intelligence agencies in the heroin trade in Vietnam during the war, coming in from the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia. That, and in certain senses, and Peter, I'm going to put this off on Peter more than me, but Peter, one of Peter's great arguments, one of his great bêtes noires, is that many military interventions, and this is certainly the way that he at least sees the Afghanistan intervention, is actually a desire to penetrate, control, and regulate narcotics productions and distribution. Now, if that is true, I'm not saying it's true, he's the expert, not me, but if that is true, then that would suggest an irrational approach to the exercise of power, because it's no longer strictly synchronized with public purpose and public interest.
And this issue of rationality really, really gets to a lot of the core of your book, because you sort of talk about this idea of ratiocination, And its role...
That means basically detection, yeah.
Right, right. And its role in the horror novel and crime fiction, and the way this sort of twins with conspiracy theory, how do these all sort of tie together, the literary and the parapolitical?
Yeah, look, when I wrote Republic of Cthulhu, I'm not really at all that interested in the details or even the veracity or the persuasiveness of any particular conspiracy theory. My approach really has more to do with literary theory, which is that, among other things, I would sort of like to break down the demarcations between crime and horror as literary genres. And I think one way of doing that is to sort of try to read both through a Lovecraftian prism, which is centrally premised upon, you know, the brain blasting of the shock of the realization that reality is quite different. Not only is different, it's actually pathologically different from common sense and everyday constructions of reality. And I think that's one thing that the really great crime novel and the really great horror novel have in common. One invokes the supernatural and the paranormal, the other one doesn't. But in both instances, you've got this kind of series of subversions, not only of moral or social normality, but epistemological and metaphysical normality. And of course, a leading example of is The Silence of the Lambs by Thomas Harris. I mean, Hannibal Lecter and the entire situation of Buffalo Bill is so completely out there that, and I think Harris at one point, I'm quoting this from memory, so I may be wrong, but I think at one point he actually said that Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, which is a much better developed character than he was in Red Dragon, that Lecter in Silence of the Lambs is based in part on Dracula, that he is, of course, not a vampire literally, but his persona and the impression that he creates is certainly Dracula-esque in certain important regards. And I think that is a very potentially fruitful way of engaging in literary analysis and literary study by focusing on horror and crime as dramas, some more moral, some more amoral, about cognitive ruptures.
That's very interesting, too, that you mentioned Thomas Harris. I know he based the Hannibal series off of his experiences in Italy during the Monster of Florence serial killer trial.
Yes.
And he sort of came to the conclusion that the person they had sort of thought was the killer, this sort of uneducated farmer, couldn't have done it, that it had to have been some educated doctor. So it becomes that in itself is like a rupture that you see.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the thing about, there are a couple of things here at play that I don't think are always distinguished adequately well. First of all, the detective genre and the crime genre are quite different. The detective genre is about the solving of the crime. This is where ratiocination comes in, and ultimately the restoration of reality and truth by solving the problem which closes the rupture. Right? So it's like post-traumatic therapy. But crime is about the infliction of the rupture. And if you're prioritizing dramatically in narrative the act of the rupturing and then examining the personalities, presuming one's a realist writer, of the actors who would deliberately rupture reality, then you are thematically going into a domain which is tantamount to the monstrous on some level. And that's how Stephen King, who I have a lot of different opinions about, but he certainly, I think, came up with the best one-line definition of the horror story, which is the horror story is the appearance of the monster and its consequences, which is conveys a understanding of rupturing. The monster, the thing that isn't supposed to be there, shows up, just exists, which is the basic brain blasting, and then compounds the rupture by doing a whole bunch of crazy stuff that everyone else either survives or they don't. And of course, the thing about the horror film or the horror narrative story, especially the horror film, I think even more than the horror story, is if you read it really carefully, you realize that it's the good guys in a sense never win, because even if you destroy the monster, what the story has done is convinced you that monsters can exist. So even if you get rid of this one, we know that the universe is structured in such a way that monstrous production is always potentially capable of taking place. And that means you simply have to wait around for the next one. Just like every time you nail a serial killer, you have to wait for the next one.
That's also something I felt like you allude to in the final portion of your book. You sort of take to task the research community that has come together in regards to the whole JFK assassination. And at one point you refer to the way they view the alleged coup in Dallas as sort of a trap. What did you mean by this?
I meant a couple of things by it. One, I do not advise people to do JFK assassination research for the simple reason that it gets very, very depressing very, very quickly, because you have to rub shoulders with people whom you don't really want to rub shoulders with for a whole bunch of different reasons. I mean, there are a lot of really desperate, sad people out there, and I think the proportion, disproportionately represented in the JFK assassination community. I mean, there are some outstanding people as well, including Peter Scott or a number of other people that I can name. But I think that the truth, the dirty truth that I discovered for myself when talking to some of these people is that they're trying desperately hard. Well, let me put it this way. They read Oliver Stone's JFK as a documentary, and they're trying desperately hard to provide evidence that the Stone view is essentially correct. Okay, it's basically the truth. And why are they so desperate about it? I mean, it's one thing to talk about the implications of Kennedy's assassination. It's one thing to speculate about whether or not there was a conspiratorial action against him at least some level. But what seems to have happened in the at least the American conspiracy population is they've simply become fixated on the Stone model. And this is it. Extremely complex, top down, to bottom, focused on preventing withdrawal from Vietnam. And all of those things are extremely contentious. None of them have been conclusively proven, but this seems to be the idée fixée of the community. And the conclusion that I came to, which I do talk about a bit in my book, is that I see basically they're turning a horror event or a crime event into a detection event. That's the difference. If they solve the crime, they can seal the rupture. If we can figure out who killed Kennedy, we can bring democracy back, because we have conceptualized the truth, and from that we can use the truth to make us free through rehabilitative, democratic, and legal action. And if you don't have that moral prejudice backing you up, it becomes really difficult to feel that what you're doing is, I'm sounding harsher than I mean to sound, but it's the best way of justifying the moral seriousness or the moral gravitas of what you're doing by literally spending your entire life trying to figure out where the second gunman was in Dealey Plaza. But it's all rehabilitative. It's restorative. It's rejuvenative. We can reclaim government if only we can figure out who was pulling the strings right then and there, because that naming and uncovering and revealing and pointing and naming and denoting brings back into truth the liberal conceit, which we were talking about at the beginning of the interview.
Right. And what's really interesting, the point that this gets at, is you point out that the primary objective of these JFK conspiracy researchers has more or less been met in a way. The majority of Americans doubt the Warren Report.
That's correct.
And yet...
So do I.
It hasn't changed
anything. More legal reasons than that, but I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah, I have a lot of, as a law scholar, I have a lot of legal reservations about the Warren Report. But please continue.
Oh, I was just going to say, you basically point out that this anthropocentric project that they take up of reclaiming liberal democracy through the revelation of this truth has actually failed, because most people already agree with
yes.
it, and it hasn't changed anything.
Well, I mean, if you wind up voting for, you know, George Bush or Donald Trump by a population that disbelieves the denial of the conspiracy of the killing of Kennedy, then you've actually refuted yourself. I mean, okay, the majority of Americans believe, at the very minimum, that the Warren report is incomplete and doesn't tell us everything. So there's grounds for suspicion. There could be a conspiracy of some kind in the margins there, you know, of the report, and that it, there's been something of a cover-up. And as a matter of fact, we know for a fact there was a cover-up of at least some things, even in advance, even before the Warren Commission actually commenced. But then with that kind of intrinsic skepticism, it doesn't seem as though that by itself has produced any change in the political culture.
Right, exactly. And that's the true, yeah. That's the horror of it, is it not?
Yeah.
And I think this also, this sort of gets into an interesting area. One of the authors you cite is actually another author that we have at Zero Books, Eugene Thacker, who has written the Philosophy of Horror trilogy for Zero. It begins with In the Dust of This Planet.
Yeah, it's a great trilogy.
And he talks about the world without us, this idea of the world without us. And you sort of propose an idea similar in parapolitics. You call it politics with, or the politics without us, or politics without form.
Yeah.
So if you could delve into that concept and how it relates to Thacker's ideas.
Yeah, because I think the politics without us or the politics without form is what we have left over from what we call democratic government. If we buy into if we accept the intellectual premises of parapolitics, as opposed to conventional politics or orthodox politics, which are basically those of the liberal conceit. If the dual state or the deep state or just the extended extrajudicial state really, first of all, is real and does create the operational effects that it appears to, then a great deal of our collective conceit concerning our own political agency has been pretty much refuted or hollowed out to a bare minimum. Like a minimum existence, what Agamemnon would call bare life. You know, it's an absolutely reduced state. So therefore, what is it exactly that we're supposed to do? I mean, you know, to put it to everybody, because the country, I know my I'm an expat, so I know that your country and my former homeland are going through this convulsion of when are we going to get rid of Donald Trump? That's fine if you hate Donald Trump. I have no problem with people who hate Donald Trump. But the problem is that I sometimes wonder whether or not there's a degree of moral hysteria in your hating of him, for the simple reason that I think one of the things that parapolitics confirms, which is what a lot of people suspect, is that it's not really that important who the president of the United States actually is, because that would presuppose that elections matter. And if you assume that elections matter, that presupposes that a whole degree of political rationality, political ethics, political normativity matter and are real. And I think that's the very thing that has to be called into question.
When I won, there were a number of people who didn't like me and didn't like what I stood for. And well, I think that whenever you get an incoming president of the other side, particularly in a bitter election like this, it takes a while for people to reconcile themselves with that new reality. Hopefully it's a reminder that elections matter and voting counts. And so, you know, I don't know how many times we have to relearn this lesson, because we ended up having 43% of the country not voting who were eligible to vote. But it makes a difference.
America, take a good look at your beloved candidates. They're nothing but hideous space reptiles. It's true. We are aliens. But what are you going to do about it? It's a two-party system. You have to vote for one of us.
He's right. This is a two-party system.
Well, I believe I'll vote for a third-party candidate.
Go ahead. Throw your vote away.
Right. I agree with that. The only thing that sort of I'm wary of when it comes to both Thacker's thinking on philosophy as sort of a form of horror and the horror of parapolitics is I think it can lead down like a very, and I guess this is a conceit of both Thacker and parapolitics is that it can sort of lead to a nihilistic attitude about things.
Yeah. Well, Peter Scott is the antithesis of nihilism. You can take my word for it. So he seems to be quite immune to that. I'm not quite so immune to it myself, though I would simply call it really a way of becoming a bit more sophisticated about one's skepticism. Because so much of skepticism in the U.S., as we know through U.S. election cycles, is really a byproduct of a kind of an apathy. I'm not advocating apathy, and certainly if you're a devoted parapolitical researcher, you are not apathetic, whatever else you may or may not be. Okay. What I'm really talking about is kind of almost like a classical Roman stoical sense of detachment that, you know, all right, this has turned out wrong. This has gone blotto. This hasn't worked. Or all of a sudden we're in a war and we had, you know, no idea. I mean, I'll tell you, honestly, I was a graduate student in the 1990s. And if somebody had gone back in time from today and told me, you know, in the year 2018, American armies will be all over the Middle East, I would have thought that was the most deranged thing I ever heard. I would have been more prepared to accept the collapse of the Soviet Union. I would have been that one. And yet this is exactly what has transpired. And I just think that there have been so many shocks to our system that we simply have no excuse for being this complacent in our prejudices and in our biases, which at the end of the day do seem to not be able to express himself in any other form than the kind of the liberal paradigm that we started out talking about.
There's just a few more questions I had if you have sure. The time. The first is one of the authors who has sort of fascinated Zero Books and our readers is Guy Debord, the situationist theorist. And he actually plays a role in your view of parapolitics. And also, I think you can compare him a little bit to horror literature in a way. So if you would like to unpack that a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, I talk about Debord a great deal more in my other book, The Spectacle of the False Flag. Because really, that's the only reason I really started talking about the JFK assassination. I was simply talking about examples which could be construed as evidence or evidentiary testimony for the reality of Debord's central notion, which was be called spectacular politics, or the power of the spectacle, which was he then reworked as the society of the spectacle. And essentially what that comes down to is really nothing more than a proposition that at some point during the 1920s, with the rise of Bolshevism in Eastern Europe and the rise of fascism in Central Europe, there has been an irreversible collapsing of politics into mass media. And as soon as you reduce politics to mass media, you can only affect governance operations through spectacle. And by spectacle, he doesn't mean cataclysmic events, although you can certainly use cataclysmic events if and when they appear, or possibly even manufacture a couple by yourself for your own purposes, like in a false flag attack, for example. But it's that everything has to be reflected through the domain of representation, media imagery, fast communication, journalistic commentary, the soundbite, the chattering class. Everything has to, this, in fact, you were talking about what I mean by governance. All these apparatuses, all these apparati are now taken on board as part of the totality of the governance function. And that's what we mean by the society of the spectacle. That there is absolutely nothing we can do that politically that is outside media. And if that is true, then what we do politically has to at least appear to be consistent with the requirements of media, media representation and media circulation.
Right, right. And I've always found something, there's this sense of horror in some of the things you see coming out of the Situationist International.
Yeah.
Another term that you bring up that I always thought was very Lovecraftian was the unspeakable. Could you describe what the unspeakable is and where it comes from?
Well, it's kind of taken from Thomas Merton, because in the 1960s, Thomas Merton wrote a very famous essay about Adolf Eichmann. It was sort of his reflections on Arndt's book, The Banality of Evil, Eichmann in Jerusalem, which is a very great but very flawed book. It's both great and flawed in the same way in different ways. But it's sort of his take on that. And what he means by the unspeakable is not so much the bureaucratic rationality and the impersonality and the alienation that Arndt was talking about, but the, shall we say, that the amoral psychopathic nihilism that underlines even that. I mean, even the bureaucratic rationality isn't really the end game, because that in itself is a reflection of something else. And of course, Merton, being a Trappist monk, obviously thought about this in basically Augustinian terms. And he settled upon a kind of a notion of evil, which is amazingly close, and I think very fruitfully close, to our contemporary notions of psychopathology and sociopathology. And it's really the sense of a total disattachment from the world, so that one is so alienated from it, the only way one can approach it is through a deliberately objectifying and abjectifying instrumentality, because our own spiritual condition allows us for no other way of engaging with the world in a manner which is interventionist and kind of, you know, I mean, broadly Promethean. I mean, we want to change things. We need to get things done. We need to make the trains run on time. We need to make sure all the planes arrive on time, so that we simply have to instrumentalize more and more, because we can't even think in any other terms other than that of practical expediency and technocratic instrumentalization.
And I think this is a good point to get into the final portion of your book, and how you sort of end it on this open note with the proposition of a new subgenre that you call weird noir. What do you mean by weird
noir?
Which
I thought was original to me, but talking to you, apparently it isn't. It's a good question. I knew what I meant when I wrote it, and to explain exactly what I meant when I wrote it, I have to think about it for a second. But I think what I wanted to do was, weird noir would be for me what both horror fiction and crime fiction would look like if we were able to completely and successfully hybridize the two genres. That's what we would have. A crime narrative that consciously takes on board all of the central genre characteristics of the horror tale, but remains secular and this worldly engaged enough that we don't actually kind of slide into the other world, although you can create all kinds of situations in which, at least subtextually or maybe even symbolically, the domains between this worldly and netherworldly sort of break down. I think Silence of the Lambs, of course, is a very good example of that. I think Libra by Don DeLillo is a very good example of that. And I think some of the literature that's coming out of what we would call post-colonial literature, post-colonial studies, a lot of Japanese novels, for example, like Grotesque or Audition, do a very, very good job of doing exactly that. That's what I would have in mind. I'm just trying to give it a name and maybe lay down some ground rules for what it should look like. And what it would look like if more people began sort of picking up on the crime genre / conspiracy theory approach to fiction.
Yes, as I told you in our little email exchange, I immediately thought of Danny Casolaro, who's very infamous in conspiracy circles due to his he was a journalist that investigated this supposed deep state conspiracy called. He ominously referred to it as the octopus.
Ah, yes, yeah. Which is kind of Cthulhu-esque, isn't it?
Yes, yes, indeed. And he actually wanted to write a book about it called Behold a Pale Horse. And when he would pitch this book to publishers, he pitched it as a novel of sorts. If I could just read a part from his pitch, I'll read it real quick. It's from the Feral House anthology Secret and Suppressed by Ken Thomas and Jim Keith. He writes, "Possession of a secret is no guarantee of its truth. And while these allegations by a handful of people are indeed remarkable, they are also wrought with undocumentable details, at least thus far, and veils of deniability masking the necessary spine for a traditional journalistic effort. It is for this reason that Behold, a Pale Horse is subtitled A True Crime Narrative." Sounds like weird noir to me.
So pretty much, yeah, that's definitely a step in the right direction.
If only we could have gotten the book.
Yeah. we'll have to wait for the movie version.
Definitely, definitely. is there anything else you'd like to go over real quickly about your future work or what you're doing right now?
Well, currently we're getting an anthology on Vietnam, the origins of the American intervention in the Vietnamese War from a parapolitical perspective, off the ground. That's actually been a project long in the making. Problem we're having with it is that academic anthologies, unlike literary poetic anthology, poetry anthologies, are not very popular at the moment. But we definitely have some very prestigious publishers who are clearly interested in it. And after that, I'll probably start doing a series of articles, possibly, I think, a monograph if somebody's interested in a Caribbean crime novel. And really because I think the weird noir approach and the parapolitical approach to crime writing and crime literature probably is more germane to what we call world literature or comparative literature than necessarily the national literature of the United States. Also, but I would put some of James Ellroy's more recent stuff as well, like Underworld USA and his new trilogy about California, which is basically about the Japanese internment during the Second World War, as very much in this domain as well. So probably something on Caribbean crime fiction, if I can ever get around to it, which would be probably not be coming out before the end of 2019 at the earliest.
On your profile on the University of Monash website, you say that you're interested in applying speculative realism to criminological discourse. We at Zero have published quite a few books on speculative realism.
Yeah, Graham wrote a very, very nice blurb for my book, so I owe him one.
I was just curious, what led you to want to apply speculative realism to criminology?
Because I'm very interested in phenomenology, and I think that one variant of speculative realism is very conducive to neo-phenomenology. And if I can make those connections between neo-phenomenology and speculative realism and then apply that to writing, to at least a certain type of crime writing, then I think I might actually be on something productive.
Well, I think Zero Books readers will be like very interested in reading your future works on these topics.
Okay, great. I'm glad somebody will be.
Well, I thank you again for joining us on the Alternatives podcast. It's been great.
Thank you very much. Thank you.